Good morning, Tony.
How are you?
Yes, I'm good, thank you. Raring to talk about someone of local interest for a change, which is lovely, isn't it?
Yeah,
A little bit closer to home.
Well, you don't get much closer to home than Redhill, really. This guy, Richard Carrington, I've got to say, put my hand up, I'd never heard of him.
No, and actually, to be honest, Tony, not many people have. Certainly, of course, in the astronomy world they have, mostly because of something called the Carrington event, which we can explain in a little bit. But no, the layperson would probably never have heard of him. And yet, he was recognised as one of Britain's greatest observers, specifically of the sun.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're talking about the 1850s and 60s, aren't we here? Really?
That's right, yes.
So yeah, they were looking through stuff that where the technology just wasn't there. They were using different methods for looking at the sky as opposed to some of the more electronic means that we've got now that can see seriously into deep space. These guys, I don't know how they did it, but you can probably explain.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, that's exactly right, Tony. We're looking at, Richard Carrington was born in 1826, so that's the era we're looking at. And of course, as you can imagine, in those days, everything in astronomy was pioneering, and that included our observations of the sun. And the thing with Richard Carrington was that he observed the sun regularly, and it was whilst he was observing that he saw solar flares. Now, we're used to, for any listener that doesn't know, a solar flare is an explosion of magnetic material, energized material from the surface of the sun. Now, for many, many years, astronomers have been aware of sunspots, which we believe they are the source of solar flares on the surface of the sun. Ever since Galileo saw the sunspots crossing the surface of the sun. And we've been watching for, centuries, but we didn't know how those affected planet Earth. Hmm. And Richard Carrington, and this was in 1859, this is what was called the Carrington event. He was observing in his observatory at Redhill, and he happened to see sunspots crossing the face of the sun, and whilst looking, two very bright white flares erupted from the surface, and he saw them. And there was another observer, I think it was, who also saw them, but they were pretty much the only two people that had. And he was amazed, he couldn't explain what they were. But then, 18 hours later, we had the most enormous aurora affecting planet Earth. I mean, we've all seen, or certainly on the TV, if not in the flesh, we've seen the beautiful aurora, which is where the atoms in Earth's atmosphere, in the magnetosphere, are energized by the solar wind from the sun, and it ignites these beautiful colors.
This is the dust in the atmosphere, isn't it?
This is the atoms and molecules in the atmosphere there. When the solar wind, this energized wind from the sun, hits the atoms, it excites them, and then they release energy. And depending on which atom or molecule it is, that determines the color, and that leads to what we know as the northern lights, the aurora. But we didn't know in the 19th century that was connected to the sun. Now, so coincidentally, for Richard Carrington, he saw the flares, and then the next day we had these aurora. He went to Kew Observatory, and the magnetometer there revealed to him that at the time of these flares, there was an enormous magnetic strike, in the recorded information. So he knew there had to be some kind of connection. And that was crucial. That was crucial in astronomy. And he became obsessed with studying the sun and trying to understand this connection. And most of his observations were made from his observatory in Redhill.
Now, I'm going to ask you, stop you there for a second, because we already mentioned the fact that the equipment they had was nothing like the electronic equipment you have today. How did they manage to look up at stuff in the sky with the equipment they had? I mean, how advanced were they with things like lenses and those sorts of things to actually see these items?
Well, pretty good, actually. Just to step back a moment, Tony, the observatory itself in Redhill was on a place called Furze Hill. It was like a leasehold plot in what was then a rural estate in Surrey. The nearest conurbation was Redhill, and it was also near the London-Brighton railway line, so he could get to and from London as well. Now, the observatory itself housed a dome with a 4.5-inch equatorial refractor.
We're getting into the technical stuff here.
We are a little bit. We don't need to go any further than that. But it was made by a company called Troughton and Sims, and they were renowned for producing the best telescopes of the time. And the observatory itself also had a shuttered sort of slit in the roof because he had a 5-inch transit circle telescope as well.
Yeah.
So these two telescopes were used to observe the night sky nightly, which is what he did. And he used the transit telescope to take accurate positions of the stars as they crossed the meridian, which ran sort of north-south through the house.
Yeah.
And he did this every night. The house itself was south-facing, had 3 stories and a pitched roof. He had an assistant, another observer called George Simmons, and a housekeeper who was sort of quartered in the 3rd-story attic room. So they all sort of looked after each other, and George helped Richard do his observations. As I say, it's a shame that the observatory no longer exists. I think it's sort of beneath 2 tower blocks now, which is very, very sad, isn't it?
Be interesting to know where they are, but it's just surprising that nobody can pinpoint the exact spot of a fairly historic building, but can still retrace the works of this guy. The question I have really in all of this is how far advanced, I mean, to try and put this some context into this, really, for anybody that has a modern day telescope, how far, I mean, what's the difference between what they had then and what's available now?
Oh, my goodness.
It's a fairly big question, but you don't need to go too far into it. But, I mean, I'm taking it there's quite a bit of a difference.
It's a big question, and it's an important question, and it's a really good question too. Because, yes, we had the telescopes in the time of Carrington, but when you think what we have now, Tony, it's a whole different ballgame. We have the most sophisticated solar telescopes ground-based, so on the surface of the planet, but also we've had these fabulous orbiting telescopes as well. So the SOHO telescope, the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, so that was in orbit around the planet. The Solar Dynamics Observatory observing the sun, which it does on a daily basis in, I'm not sure how many wavelengths, but it's looking at it across the electromagnetic spectrum. And what it's seeing is absolutely mind-blowing. The Parker Solar Probe, which is a probe that is the fastest spacecraft we've ever launched. And that is actually what they call touching the sun. It's going, dipping into the corona, into where we think the solar wind actually originated. So we're literally getting up close and personal to our star, which is something we could never have dreamed of
doing. I was going to say, this is well beyond the dreams of Richard Carrington. He must have been amazed at what he'd seen then. But had he have been around today, would have truly been bowled over by what's available and what you can actually see. But the thing is,
he would, Tony, because it would have been affirmation of what they were theorising and then finding the evidence for.
Well, I was going to say that the fact is that they achieved an awful lot with not an awful lot, if you know what I mean, compared to today. And the basis for everything that is being done today, I suppose the foundations were laid then and before then, weren't they?
Indeed. And I think a couple of the big achievements that Carrington made whilst he was in the Observatory of Redhill was his announcement that the sun wasn't a solid body. It had what we call a differential rotation, which means it rotates at different speeds. So at the equator, it was completing a rotation in 25 days. But he realised that at the higher latitudes, it took an extra 3 days. So 28 days, it's slower at the poles than at the equator, which was confirmation that the sun, our star, was a completely gaseous body, which is incredible. And also, he noticed by observing the solar cycle, he noticed that the sunspots appeared mainly in the higher latitudes at the beginning of the cycle, and they would progressively approach the equator towards the solar maximum, and then 11 years later they would go back towards the poles again. And that's to do with the inversion of the magnetic poles, so they swap from north to south and back again. And he realized that by his, you know, assiduous studying of what the sun was doing on a daily basis, which is just incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, had he had more money, I think he would have could have achieved an awful lot more. But he was always kind of strangled, really, by his father in the brewery, having to run the brewery. Yeah. When his father died, he then had to go back to the brewery and look after his the widowed mother and his brother, David, who had mental health issues as well. So he was a little bit thwarted. In particular, the movements of the sunspots. Another German astronomer, Gustav Sporer, actually took the credit for that. And it's now known, the solar cycle is now known as Sporer's Law. Had Carrington had the opportunity, the time and the finance, I think he would have been given the credit for that, which is very sad, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, how much more do we know about the sun today than we did then? Because it's not the easiest thing to look at, is it?
Oh, gosh, no. We're using a coronagraph, for example, which is the equivalent of observing an eclipse. We've been able to see the corona, which is the enormous atmosphere of the sun, which we haven't been able to see before. And that has temperatures of something like 1,000,000 degrees. And astronomers and scientists nowadays are trying to understand why the corona, which is further from the core of the sun, is hotter than the surface of the sun, the photosphere, which is 6,000 degrees. So we know that the atmosphere extends a long way into space, and of course the solar wind, so that, you know, the energized plasma of gas that is blown out into the solar system and beyond at speeds of 1,000,000 to sometimes 2,000,000 miles an hour.
Mind-boggling statistics.
It is, isn't it? We know about the flares happening all over the sun, coronal mass ejections. This is where there are enormous expulsions of gas from the surface of the sun, so energetic that they break free of the gravitational hold of the sun and blast out into the solar system and beyond. We know more about nanoflares. So the sun itself is covered in tiny flares, and these may well be the origin of the solar wind. There's so much more that we know now than we did then.
Right. I was going to say that the one interesting thing, because last week I did a thing on questions you might get in employment, and one of them was, what would you do if the sun went out? Which is kind of a ridiculous question in itself, because everybody knows if it wasn't the sun, we wouldn't be here.
No, that's true. But the sun actually won't go out in terms of exploding overnight. So
no.
It's there today and gone tomorrow.
Yeah.
What will happen to the sun, and because of its original size, it will bloat up. It will swell up into what we call a red giant, a dying star, because it's running out of fuel. It will engulf the nearest planet, Mercury. It will engulf Venus. It is thought now that it won't engulf our planet. Because the gravitational hold will change, the Earth will actually start drifting away from the sun. But all life, without a doubt, on this planet will die.
Yeah.
So it's not an overnight process, but so the sun will die.
It's
in
a way,
about 5
a way away,
billion
isn't
years,
it?
So don't worry.
It's a way away. No, my point, the question I was trying to ask was, because you've mentioned solar flares, and seriously, the sun has a major impact on how things are on Earth, and there's a very controversial subject going on about climate change at the moment, and there's a school of thought that would say that the solar flares have an effect. How true would that be?
Very true. They do. The extent of the effect depends on the size of the flare. As I was saying, Tony, there are small flares on the entire surface of the sun. Then there are larger flares that happen all the time, and they contribute to the solar wind. So in effect, I suppose, we are being affected by the sun all the time in the form of the solar wind, us and all the planets of the solar system. But if you have a potentially a large flare, what we call like an X1 flare, very large, very bright, then that has the potential to cause disruption to all the planets, especially ours, because of course we're dependent on technology. A large flare would cause significant magnetic electrical disruption to our technology on this planet, and actually make the electrical currents cease, which has happened before. I mean, it happened at the time of the Carrington event in 1859. It will definitely happen today. It will disrupt spacecraft. It will disrupt the satellites because it enlarges the atmosphere, which causes significant drag. If there are astronauts on the surface of the moon or Mars, where we're hoping to go, if they're there at the time of a significant flare, then it could be fatal.
And all of this, of course, can't be predicted, can it? It's just if it happens, it will just happen. Would that be right?
Yes, but that now, I mean, we are looking at things like trying to predict it. And the more we study the sun, the more we have these fabulous, sophisticated spacecraft studying the sun from afar and now up close, the more it's allowing us to build models so that we can predict when a large flare is probably going to hit. So, and then we can take the necessary precautions. So that's definitely something that they are working on.
Yeah, man's advancement in all of this, of course, quite staggering. And all of this comes out of the work of various different astronomers. And of course, the one we're talking about today from Redhill, Richard Carrington. So he lived in the area. He's even had a school named after him, hasn't he?
Yes, he has. So I think it's Warwick School.
That's right,
in Redhill. Yep, has been renamed Carrington School. A number of the local roads are named after him and his work. And he won the Royal Astronomical Society's Gold Award for his Redhill catalogue of stars. So he catalogued something like 3,500 stars that were all within 9 degrees of the North Magnetic Pole. Mm. So, yeah, he was a very, very busy chap. And the rotations of the sun are called Carrington rotations after him. So, yeah,
now we know.
Fabulous. And he lived at Churt in Surrey for a while as well. That's where he sort of met his wife and settled down.
Yeah, amazing. We could talk about this guy all day long, and I'm sure at some point we will come back and touch on it again. But one of the things that you do outside of sort of talking on the radio is you also do talks about astronomy in various different places, and I know you did one fairly recently, and a Susie Radio listener actually spoke to you about some of this stuff.
Yes, that was Peter Hill, actually.
Yeah, Peter.
And I need to thank Peter Hill. Peter Hill very kindly alerted me to Rich and Carrington's observatory in Redhill. So we have him to thank. Thank you, Peter. And yes, thank you very much, Tony. I'm doing a talk, a tour of the universe, no less. And that's on the evening of Wednesday, the 21st of February. Doors open at 7. The talk starts at 7:30, and it's for the Wadhurst and Tunbridge Wells Astronomical Society. And it'll be at Beechwood School, which is in Pembury Road, Royal Tunbridge Wells. But if you go to the Wadhurst Astro website, all the details are there.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's open to anyone to go along, though, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yeah.
Yeah, because it's a little outside of the Susie Radio area, but for anybody that's interested in this, it's a fascinating subject that you can hear about, and you'll be, listening to somebody who has a wonderful way of putting things. I know it's you, Jane, because I've seen some of your presentations before with that wonderful ability to make the rather large and enormous seem actually believable.
Oh, thank you very much, Tony. There you go. That's a good advert.
There you go. Wednesday, it's on next Wednesday, the 21st of February. The detail will be up at susieradio.com along with this conversation very, very shortly, all the details of that. Jane, it's been good to catch up today, and I've certainly learnt an awful lot, and without even looking up in the sky at any of the stars today. So, Jane Green, for now, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you for having me, Tony.